Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 144 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, we feature the second part of non-fiction writer John Kaye's conversation with James McConachy, discussing Relics of Empire and Roving Scots, the other writers in John's family, and the hectic schedule of non-fiction writers with new books to promote. You can hear the first part of this interview in episode 141.
If it's dangerous to meet your heroes, it's surely more perilous to interview them. But the writer, historian, traveller and Indologist John Kaye, I hope I've put those in the right order, John, is one of the very few non-fiction authors whose oeuvre I've followed and consumed almost in its entirety. Well, not quite, because he published his first book in 1973, which was the year I was born, and has published some 20 works of non-fiction since, including a suite of books about the discovery of the Himalayas and matchless histories of India and China. So, I don't want to keep singling out books of yours as ones I particularly like, but The Great Arc, describes the survey of India, which finally measured the height of the Himalayas, or Himalaya, and found them to be as high as they are. Rather movingly, you describe coming across remnants of the triangulation. You'll have to describe better than I could.
Yes, when you're triangulating, you're measuring something, the size of India, for instance, you do it with by a system of triangulation. And I won't go into the mathematics or the physics of this, but basically you need towers and you sight from eminences of one sort or another to another, and you measure angles and you measure the ground by this triangling, if you like. And one or two of these towers do still survive around Delhi. But the most interesting relic, really, from that exercise was discovering that the house where George Everest, the man after whom the mountain was called, and who it was named after him because he was responsible for completing this measurement in India, which made it possible to measure the heights of the Himalayas. The house that he operated from and that he conducted this amazing survey from is still standing, but just the shell of it. It occupies the most sensational site imaginable. It's on a ridge, and you go out the back door and you see the whole panorama of the Himalayan peaks, these white, jagged snow peaks stretching right across the horizon. And you go out the front door and look down to the plains and you just look out over India and you can actually see, so it said, I've never seen, see the Qutub Minar in Delhi from the front doorstep. And this building is really sad, but as I say, the shell still survives, and I'm very much hoping that the Indian government or the state government for that area, it's near Mussoorie in what's now Uttarakhand state, in the north of what used to be Uttar Pradesh state, that they may be persuaded to take the building in hand, at least make sure it's structurally sound, and maybe find some other use for it as a retreat or a museum or something like that.
If I could gift you a bungalow stroke chalet stroke palace in India, would it be a situation like that?
That would do fine. Yes, that's, James, that's very kind. No, it is the most superb position, and an 18th century building in that extraordinary location, it would be hard to think of anywhere comparable.
The epigraph at the beginning of The Great Arc, you quote Wordsworth. I'll re-quote it at you briefly. No, he says, that on the summit whither thou art bound, a geographic labourer pitched his tent, with books supplied and instruments of art to measure height and distance. Lonely task, week after week pursued. It did strike me that was this a self-referential description of the life of the writer? I mean, you are measuring height and distance in some way in as a historian, as someone who unearths archives and explores the world.
I must say, I'm not hyper-conscious of what I'm doing as a writer. Writing is quite a lonely activity, I agree, but it's also quite a sociable one in the sense that every book is the product of not just of the author's imagination and researches, but of the collaboration and encouragement and so on that he or she may receive from any number of other people. The loneliness of writing is never really nearly troubled me. On the contrary, I find myself having to push people away or ignore emails and so on in a rather rude way, because I want to create the solitary atmosphere that's vital to writing.
You did collaborate directly with your late wife,
yes.
Julia Kaye. Mm-hmm. What was it like to write with your wife?
Well, except in the case of encyclopedias, we didn't work on the same book, but we did work very closely together in that I would never finish a chapter without showing it to her, and vice versa, she wrote her own books too. So we were one another's editors, if you like. But the only books we worked on together were encyclopedias, and for that we would kind of divide up the terrain fairly carefully. So in the case of the Collins Encyclopedia of Scotland, you know, I said, OK, you can do with Scottish music. I don't know anything about Scottish music, but I'll happily deal with the entry on farming or whatever. So we carved it up between us. I don't know how two people would do write together. I mean, you can alternate chapters or something, but I don't think that would be very satisfactory. I think what usually happens is one person writes it and then the other person rewrites or edits it. That was something we were doing all the time. So when she died, of course, I was a bit lost. When you're used to working to the same editor all the time, it makes a big difference if she's no longer there to tell you you're being absurd or you're expecting too much of the reader or whatever.
Your daughter is yes. also publishing writing history.
Yes. Mm.
Do you have a collaborative relationship there as well?
I suppose so. I mean, I've had four children and they've all sort of gone from school to university and so on. And so I've sort of developed a habit of really helping them with their writing assignments. And this has progressed from university to writing a bit of journalism in some cases. And then in the case of my elder daughter, Anna, to writing books. She did send me a draft of her recent book, which is called The Last Royal Rebel. It's a biography of the Duke of Monmouth, Charles II's illegitimate son. I was, you know, very honoured, but I don't think I was really an awful lot of help to her. I would like to have been more help, and I did make one or two suggestions. And to be honest, I haven't read the final version of the book to know whether she actually took them on board or not. But she's a perfectly capable writer, and she doesn't need a meddlesome father.
Did you discern any traces of a stylistic inheritance, I wonder?
No, I don't think so. I think probably she's a much better writer than I am. She's terribly excited by narrative and good at narrative, and I don't think I'm particularly good at narrative. And as a historian, she's a much more, I mean, for this particular book anyway, has done far more research than I would have done for many of my books. She spent weeks in the public record of Chancery Lane and the archives, and it's all beautifully annotated in terms of the sources, whereas I tend to cut corners a bit sometimes.
You are a British historian writer writing about India. Have you encountered problems, accusations of kind of a novel kind of colonialism?
No, I mean, I'm quite sensitive to that, but I don't think, I can't remember any problems. Something like the Jaipur Book Festival, which you've been to, you occasionally get a few people there who are quite out to make a bit of trouble, and they were saying something like, why should you be writing about Indian history? And I always respond, well, you know, I think it's good that people write about histories other than that of their own country, and I would encourage them to write a history of Scotland or to try a history of the Tudors and Stuarts. I think that outsiders very often bring a more interesting perspective to the subject than someone who's been brought up on Tudors and Stuarts since they first went to school. And that seems to me unlikely to write anything very exciting.
There can be
new on the subject.
Political problems, though, contested histories, communalism, where whether such and such a temple was in fact a mosque before it was a temple or vice versa,
oh, yes.
I mean, conspicuously.
Yes.
And if, well, especially when you've written contemporary history, which you described in Midnight's Descendants as fraught with pitfalls, you can get yourself in trouble, can you not?
Yes. I mean, you know, the political climate tends to change quite frequently. And at the moment, for instance, in India, it's very difficult to write anything about Hindu-Muslim relations without upsetting someone. It's also very difficult, funnily enough, to write about very early Indian history because the current dispensation in India is very Hindu nationalist. And so if you start saying that the origins of the Aryan people in India were that they came from outside India, then you're liable to attract an awful lot of correspondence from people who are incensed that you should suggest that the origins of Hinduism and of Indian nationalism, if you like, are to be found outside India rather than within it. But if someone says I'm talking absolute rubbish, I usually try and reason with them and say it's not absolute rubbish and give them the evidence as I understand it.
You're also part of a long tradition of Scots travelling in India. I mean, you yourself quoted Lord Rosebery, who talked about the Scotticisation of India. Are you part of an ongoing...
Yes, I mean, the obvious example is William Dalrymple, who is obviously from Edinburgh and lives in Delhi and writes about India. There are quite a lot of others, and I think there's always been some sort of connection between Scotland and India, going back to the late or mid-18th century. An awful lot of Scots families sent one or more of their children out to India to redeem the family fortunes. And a lot of them were very, very successful. So there was a moment in British rule in India, particularly in the late 18th and early 19th century, when the Scots played a really influential role in all services, in government, in the army, in the sciences and so on in India. So Scottish role in India particularly, but throughout the empire really, has always been quite disproportionate. And the wandering Scot was a bit like the wandering Jew, and it was a sort of stock figure of the empire.
And your work is recognised in Scotland, and I think you were honoured in a rather peculiar way recently, or fairly recently.
Oh, I know, yes. I think every year when the Scottish Parliament assembles, there's a procession down the Royal Mile of all the members, MSPs, members of the Scottish Parliament, and they're allowed to invite one or maybe two guests a lot to accompany them from their own constituencies. So, yes, I did accompany my local members of the Scottish Parliament on this sort of procession down to the Parliament buildings, which I'd never been to before and which I rather liked. And they're not sort of impressive in the same way as Westminster, but I thought it had a sort of nice feeling of a government in business and not too concerned with its image, but concerned with getting things done. And then there was a lunch, I think.
What forms of recognition do matter to you? I mean, there are reviews, there are prizes, there are invitations, there's the work itself. What really counts?
Well, reviews are important, not because they sell books, because I don't think they do really, but it's the nearest thing to kind of direct feedback that you get on your work, really. Yes, I mean, reviews I do pay attention to. I think I got a medal from the Royal Society of Asian Affairs for literary contribution. I like that, literary contribution to South Asian studies, I think. So there were a few little honours like that that come along. And then you get asked to speak a lot, but then that's very often to do with promoting a book, so to book festivals. Curious thing is that non-fiction has a pretty high profile at these book fests, and writers of non-fiction seem to be as popular as some of our much better known novelists and poets and so on. Nowadays you're expected, if you have a new book, to go and promote it at innumerable book festivals. I don't know how many there are. Just in the United Kingdom, there must be 100 or so, I should think. And some of them are very big and some of them are not very big. So you do get asked to speak, and it always seems to me slightly ironic because the one thing that a writer probably can't do is speak. You know, they would much rather be in their ivory towers and not have to speak to anyone at all, let alone to a public audience.
Looking back over the last 43 years since the first book, is there one you would single out as closest to your heart or where you've most nearly achieved what you would like to have achieved with a book?
That's not very easy. As I was explaining, the books that don't sell are very often the books that I enjoyed writing most, and the books that do sell are not those that I'm necessarily particularly proud of or work my ideas in the first place. I think if I had to choose a book, I wrote a book on the Middle East. I've only written one book on the Middle East. It was called Sowing the Wind, The Seeds of Conflict in the Middle East. And it's just been reissued by the Folio Society, a rather nice edition, which came out, I suppose, about 15 years ago. And I was particularly pleased with that book, and it did have very wonderful reviews, but it actually didn't sell particularly well. The Middle East was somewhere I knew and had been to a bit, but I'd never actually written about before. And so it was a slightly risky venture for me. But I thought the book that emerged from it was a kind of mixture of a kind of accessibility and insight, which is what I would like to aim at in other books. So I think that was, I wouldn't say it's my favourite, but it's a book that I was perhaps most pleased with, and certainly was delighted with its reception. Sowing the Wind, The Seeds of Conflict in the Middle East.
And where would you most readily go back to? I mean, you've travelled pretty much all around the world. Is there a place that's nearest home that isn't actually home?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, although I've written mostly about places in Asia, I mean, I have travelled quite a lot and spent a lot of time in Europe too. I never actually wanted to live in India or Southeast Asia. I love visiting and I love having a few weeks there, but I never wanted to live there, but I wouldn't mind living in parts of France or Spain or Italy, or Sicily maybe, or Greece. So
the list seems to be going.
So I think I'd be rather boring and suggest that I would be quite happy on the Mediterranean.
John Kay, it's been an honour to speak with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, James.
That was John Kay in conversation with James McConachie. You can find out more about John on his website at www.johnkay.com. That's K spelled K-E-A-Y. And that concludes episode 144, which was recorded by James McConachie and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 145, poet and short story writer Brian McCabe speaks with Jeff Hattersley about why mathematicians are a bit like artists, how something being funny doesn't mean it's light, and the process of imaginatively recreating the worldview of a child. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.